SBC Media.
Welcome to the iGaming Daily Podcast, analysing the news from the betting and gaming industry all over the globe, supported by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market.
Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Indigenous Voices by iGaming Daily. I am Kelly Weaver, enrolled member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. I will be your host. I am also the VP of Relationships for North America at SBC. I'd like to introduce my first guest to Indigenous Voices, Jacob Coyne, a member of the Hopi Tribe and executive advisor at San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. Jacob has an extensive background in tribal gaming and has served as the executive director of the California Nations Indian Gaming Association, executive director of the Indian Gaming Association, and is a founding executive director of the Arizona Indian Gaming Association. Before we get started, I have a message from our sponsor. iGaming Daily is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for iGaming market. 56% of the EGR Power 50 personalized player experiences with Optimove. And as another special offer, Optimove is offering new clients a free first month when they buy Optimove. For more information and claim the free month, go to optimove.com/SBC. So Jacob, welcome to our inaugural episode of Indigenous Voices. I'm so glad to have you here.
Kelly, thank you. I want to just say thank you for inviting me to be a part of the show this morning. It's a privilege for me to be invited, so I thank you very much for that.
Well, I appreciate your extensive knowledge in tribal gaming. I know when we first met last year in person, I talked to you previously, but we met at the Canadian Gaming Summit, and I think we were inseparable there for a bit, just talking about everything that involves tribes and looking at the similarities, with our relatives up north with the First Nations.
Yeah, I really enjoyed my participation there at the SBC Summit last year. And I got to tell you, SBC has become one of my favorite groups to be hosting these kinds of events, because I think you're a bit more entrepreneurial. I think you are innovative and certainly have great vision about government gaming as it affects tribes. And I want to encourage the SBC to continue exploring new ideas, new levels, new dimensions, because that's what we need for our industry to not only survive, but prosper. And I appreciate, again, the good work that you and SBC do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It has been, I love my role with SBC in working with tribes and First Nations. And, it goes beyond the gaming portion of this, right? I'm tribal, you're tribal. You see the impacts of gaming, and that I kind of want to discuss a little bit of that today and share with the audience, because I don't think they, if you're not an enrolled member of a tribe, I think it's difficult to understand why we have tribal gaming. It's much different than commercial gaming. The reasons behind that.
There are some very critical differences between tribal government gaming and commercial gaming. But if I can, I'd like to just share a quick glimpse of the history of where we came from. I think everyone acknowledges today that the Seminole Tribe of Florida was the one who explored this area of offering, gaming on their lands in the late 70s. And of course, they encountered a lot of challenges, legal challenges from the state and local governments there in Florida, and eventually prevailed. And when that happened, tribes here in California began to take note and started to explore their own possibilities. And in fact, a group here from San Manuel, where I'm currently employed, took a group from San Manuel to visit the Seminoles in Florida to try to see firsthand exactly what was going on. And I can tell you that the group that went down there, which included the chairman of the tribe here at San Manuel at the time, Chairman Henry Duro and his tribal council. They went down there and visited and came back with some interesting outlooks and a vision for what could be done here with San Manuel. The long and short of it is that there was a great need to generate government revenues. And unlike local governments, unlike state governments, and unlike the federal government, we don't have the kind of tax base that is required to be able to generate sufficient revenues to be able to build roads, build schools, build hospitals, develop the infrastructure, water systems, utilities, provide services, education, healthcare, and the like. And there was just a need for a level of revenues that would enable tribes to be able to fulfill their government obligations to their people. And lo and behold, government gaming came around. But again, it didn't go without some challenges. Here in California, two tribes, the Morongo Band of Mission Indians and the Cabazon Band of Mission Indians, were challenged in court regarding their authority to offer gaming on their lands. And the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Indian tribes have a governmental right to operate gaming on their lands without the state or local governments interfering in that right. Now, that was a monumental ruling. I mean, it didn't give tribes gaming. It affirmed the fact that they already had a right to offer gaming on their lands without state or local governments interfering. And so, it was a monumental day for tribes. And of course, like anything else in the history of Native Americans, anytime tribes had something of value, someone was coming up with ways to take it away. And then this was no different. Again, the ruling came from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1987. About a year later, in fact, 20 months later, if you count the months, the ruling came down from the Supreme Court in February. By October of 1988, the Congress was persuaded to enact the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which again put, the claim on the part of the Congress was it was creating a statutory framework for gaming to be conducted on Indian lands. And of course, one of the provisions in IGRA, as we call it, basically required that if a tribe in any given state wanted to offer class 3 or casino style gaming, they first had to negotiate a gaming compact with that state. And the gaming compact, was designed only, as far as federal law goes, to negotiate over scope of gaming, what kind of gaming would be offered, and then secondly, a way to regulate, that gaming activity. And of course, now we know that the states, basically wanted revenue shares and all kinds of different things. And so the compacts today are quite a bit different from what we envisioned IGRA having required as a part of the compact negotiations.
It's interesting that you bring that up because, it says that to cover the fees of the state to regulate. And, I know that often comes up, the amount, then they put a dollar amount or a percentage on that, and so when you look at those budgets, they're very large, and it's far more than what it costs to regulate, in my opinion. And so, it just seems like another opportunity for money to be made off of tribal casinos, and that's really unfortunate.
Well, again, there were some interesting policy discussions while the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was being debated in the Congress. And Senator John McCain from Arizona, in one of those meetings, basically, stated that during the negotiating phase for IGRA, that it appeared to him that whatever was the federal government's is theirs, whatever was the state government's is theirs, and whatever was the tribe's was completely negotiable. and that's how this whole situation really came to be, was was that the states and the federal government, they were firm in their positions regarding tribal government gaming, but whatever the tribes wound up with was to be negotiated between the three entities. I mean, it was there was a balance to be struck between federal interests, state interests, and tribal interests, but the negotiating lever was clearly not in the in the hands of tribal governments at that time.
Well, and I think, you know, early on, it was used as, you know, to keep corruption out of the tribes because we didn't know how to manage the amount of money that we would be taking in. And, you know, you can look back and say maybe we didn't have, you know, the CFOs we have today or the attorneys that we have today. But at some point that, you know, that shifted, and we do, yet we still have all of the regulations. I know in my former position, I worked in background screenings, and we compared the types of screenings that we had to do on employees and companies, you know, for a commercial operator versus a tribal operator, much more extensive. And that backgrounding, you know, going back 10 years of criminal history and residency and any license they've ever held. And I appreciate the due diligence and keeping corruption out of the casino, but it's mandated. That's the, you know, and if you were just to walk into a regular commercial casino, you know, the cost of it too, you're paying much less, much more for a tribal gaming background. And so, you know, times have certainly changed in our level of education, which is part of gaming. You know, when we look at tribal gaming and the benefits back to our membership, and I think it was possibly a video I saw from California that talked about, you know, this goes back to we don't have shareholders, we have tribal members. Commercial gaming has shareholders. So our monies are going directly back into our communities to fund, as you mentioned earlier, you know, insurance programs and healthcare. We have our own hospitals. We have our own emergency services, our own, you know, education systems, colleges. And, you know, we also have grant funding. You know, I received a scholarship from my tribe to get my master's degree. That was all due or as a result of gaming, and very appreciative of that. And so we look at how do we give back, but it goes a little bit beyond that, in that we also provide that infrastructure to the communities where our tribes are, the outlying communities. So, you know, the townships that butt up against our reservations, you know, we are providing emergency services for them as well. And that's fire and EMS and ambulatory. You know, we're taking care of the roads. I worked at the Eastern Shawnee Tribe as the director of Children and Family Services, and we had a back to school powwow every year that provided backpacks full of school supplies for any child, not just tribal children, but any child that came to that powwow. And so we are constantly giving back to the communities, not for any sort of tax write-off, but because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, what you started out with were these claims that somehow Indian gaming was going to be overrun by organized crime and corruptive influences and the like, and these were assertions that were floated mostly by the commercial gaming interests, because Nevada, Las Vegas, especially, was fearful of what could happen in, you know, as a result of California tribes getting, you know, executing on their right to game. There was a National Gambling Impact Study Commission that was formed in the late 90s by the Congress to do a factual study of the impacts of gambling on the U.S. And one of the their findings in the course of holding hearings and out in the field and in Washington, D.C. and different places was that up to 70% of the traffic that goes to Las Vegas comes from or through California. You know, so, I mean, that's what the commercial gaming interests were afraid of, was if they somehow, if tribes were somehow able to get gaming going and do it in such a, at such a level that it would be competitive with the Las Vegas gaming enterprises, then they did stand to lose, you know, a good share of the market that they enjoyed. But the fact of it is, I mean, they, you know, the regulation of Indian gaming or tribal government gaming is, I mean, there's no other sector of the gaming industry in this country that is more regulated at more layers of government than tribal government gaming. You know, first of all, we have our own tribal gaming commissions, which under law have primacy in regulating, you know, the gaming activity. Then you have, through the compact, state governments having a role in regulating the gaming activity. And then, of course, on top of that, you've got the federal government through the National Indian Gaming Commission, and tribal gaming facilities also have to comply with rules that are issued by the Internal Revenue Service, the Department of Treasury, you know, Department of Justice, and all kinds of different federal agencies that are part of the mechanism that ensures that tribal government gaming is above board. We have way too much to lose if there was ever any sort of impropriety taking place at tribal casinos. As you mentioned, you know, without tribal gaming revenues, roads just don't get built or improved. Without tribal gaming revenues, hospitals don't get built. Education doesn't take place, or at least not at the level that we're seeing now, and elder services aren't provided. You know, youth programs aren't provided. Language preservation programs aren't carried on. And then the reclamation of culture and cultural activities, you know, will tend to fade away. And there has been nothing but good things coming out as a result of tribal government gaming. And people are beginning to see that now. Cultures, again, are strengthened. Languages are strengthened. Community services are strengthened. And probably the most important thing is our relationship with surrounding communities through philanthropy and outreach and working with local governments on traffic and law enforcement and public safety and fire protection. All of these things are possible because of the success of tribal government.
Absolutely. Gaming. You know, NIGC put out some numbers last year. You know, the gaming revenues were $40.9 billion. The American Gaming Association also released their numbers on commercial, which put them at $60 billion. I don't know if the AGA included maybe some of the tribal commercially operated properties, such, you know, as the Palms, Seminole Hard Rock. You know, we are seeing tribes venture more into commercial properties. I was at the Palms last week for an event, and that is actually part of San Manuel's expansion over into Vegas. And how have you seen that? Have you seen the impact, you know, from increasing your traffic at San Manuel when they're going over, or Yamava when they're going over to the Palms? Are you seeing similar players back and forth?
Our casino operations folks are probably keeping track of all of that data and the numbers. But I can tell you from a tribal government standpoint, they have a duty. Tribal governments, tribal leaders today have a duty to secure the future for their people, if they can, for seven generations out and beyond. And the only way we can do that in this world today, unfortunately, is by ensuring that the financial future of the tribe is not only stable, but has enough potential to be able to grow and take care of future needs. And so that's the reason that diversification by tribes is such an important undertaking. In this case, San Manuel has determined that their core competency is gaming and hospitality. You know, so they've done what they can to engage in expansion activities to purchase operations primarily in casino and hospitality hotels and the like. And again, because that's what they determined is their core competency, and their ability to be successful is greatly enhanced when you do what you do best and don't try to do something that you're not really qualified to do. So that was the reason that the Palms was a part of their acquisition a few years ago. You know, they've got hotels in Washington, D.C. They've got a hotel in Sacramento. They've got a hotel in Charlottesville, Virginia. They just bought a share of the Waldorf Astoria down in Monarch Beach. And these kinds of things are always a part of this tribe's thinking. And you got to applaud them for that. They are a tribe with a vision. They're a tribe with a commitment to securing the future of their tribe. And they're a tribe that is going to ensure that the vision that they lay out is they're going to have a way to be able to execute on those plans. And there's a number of tribes around the country that are doing the very same thing. You've got to applaud them.
I agree. And applaud them and just appreciate the inspiration they provide for other tribes. And just to lead, you know, we need those tribes leading and teaching us, you know, the path kind of to follow, where we should be going. It's been wonderful speaking with you today, Jacob. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to having you back on Indigenous Voices. We have a lot to talk about, other things such as player protection, and we've had some really good discussions, and I would like to share those with the audience as well. But I thank you for coming on this first episode, and hope to have you back.
Thank you, Kelly. And may I just share one final thought before we leave? Back in the early 90s, I remember tribal leaders all over the country were describing tribal gaming at that time as the new buffalo. You know, and Native people will understand what that means, the fact that anytime there was a buffalo hunt, a successful buffalo hunt, every member of that tribe or that tribal community benefited from that. You know, from that, from a successful hunt. Not only that, but every part of the buffalo was used for food, for clothing, for tools, for any number of things that was needed for that community. And we can, I think, look at tribal gaming today and through that same prism that this is the new buffalo, and we must do everything we can to ensure that our communities benefit from, you know, the conduct of good, effectively regulated gaming on our lands.
Thank you for that. That's a great story. Is shelter. You know, as you were saying, all the things we would use the buffalo for, you know. But thank you so much, Jacob. Those are some good words to end on, and I appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to today's iGaming Daily Podcast, supported by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market. If you want to find out more about some of the subjects raised today, feel free to explore any of the sites in the SBC News Network or check out the latest edition of the SBC Leaders Magazine. Happy reading.